Hello and welcome back to Millennial, and I'm here now with Jay Burden, who is a YouTuber, content creator, who I recently became aware of. I'm not on YouTube, as everyone knows, so I tend not to, it's difficult for me to keep tabs on what's going on there. Just to be clear, I lost my account as well as my channel, so it's not the easiest thing. But now and then I go and have a look around. And Jay Burden is an up-and-coming figure in our movement, in our community. So welcome to Millennial.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a privilege.
Well, you're welcome. So why don't you introduce yourself and your work to the audience?
All right. I'm Jay Burden. And on YouTube, Apple, and Spotify, I host a roughly 2 to 3 times a week interview show. I basically have hour-long interviews, oddly, you know, roughly similar to the format here, where I interview, you know, people across our movement. I'm probably best known for being, I think, the second largest repository of Thomas 777 interviews. Obviously, Pete Quinones, he has that one, you know, down pat. But I host a lot of interviews with him. I've hosted, you know, people like AA, Radical Liberation. I just had on, Charles Haywood of the Worthy House. And generally what I try to do is, you know, provide kind of an introduction, you know, to different people's work. And I like to think that I ask kind of unique or interesting questions in kind of a cozy conversational tone. So that's my work. Obviously, you can find me on YouTube, where I probably my biggest platform, but also, you know, Apple, Spotify, those type of podcatchers. So that's, I guess, the summation of what I do.
Excellent. I certainly agree with you that there is a place for a cozy interview style content. I certainly hope there is. but one question just to start off with is quite interesting, because you were saying there about the various content creators that you're involved with. I have used the term the AA sphere, the academic agent sphere, in the past. I'm not sure if that's entirely fair, because there are prominent people other than AA involved in it. But how would you characterize that sphere? For the benefit of people who might not be familiar with it, I mean, obviously, I go back to 2014, and it wasn't even the alt-right in those days. There wasn't even a name for it, to be honest. But the React sphere was one name. Then the alt-right. What would you say is going on in YouTube nowadays that wasn't going on in 2016, let's see.
So just to clarify, I'm on the younger end of things. So I'm 23 years old, so I'm not exactly, you know, kind of an old hand. But, you know, that said, I have been, you know, on the right-wing internet probably actively since 2016 or 2017. And what I would say is that essentially, as YouTube has gotten more and more strict, obviously you were banned, you know, a lot of people who are surprisingly mild have been banned, you know, essentially for wrong things. There's been kind of a forced coalescence around academic agent. And AA is obviously, you know, high quality academic, you know, writes a lot, but I guess primarily online is known for his, you know, panel live streams. He has a couple, you know, set up every week. And so that's kind of formed an informal network of people around him. You know, so he has regulars. And I wouldn't necessarily say I'm a regular. I think I've been invited on one of his shows. So a total of 2 appearances. And out of that, we've seen kind of several different camps form. So there have been people like Aaron McIntyre, obviously, who just got a job, you know, at The Blaze, who's kind of gone on to have his own career. But additionally, you know, people like, you know, The Prudentialist, who I'm good friends with, who have been kind of, you know, launched and fostered by that sphere. And again, within that, there's a pretty wide diversity, you know, the ideological sense. Of opinion.
Of course.
Yeah. Although I guess if you really wanted to be granular about it, but nonetheless. So again, I don't mean to make myself out to be an insider. I'm most definitely not. You know, I'm a newcomer, but it has been kind of this, because there's been so much outside pressure, you know, essentially, you know, lopping off, you know, the branches of the bonsai tree that get too far out, you know, it has kind of forced this tight-knit community on the platform of people who are, let's just say, circumspect about, you know, what they will discuss and what terms they will use to discuss it. And I don't think it's entirely negative. Obviously, it is you know, we've lost a lot of great people, yourself included, and it's become essentially impossible to grow past a certain number. But nonetheless, it is essentially provided kind of an enforced professionalism. You know, like if you say all the gamer words, you know, if you start just ranting about, you know, certain ethnic groups, you're going to be gone instantly. And so it kind of has forced people to become a little bit more approachable, which again, who knows, maybe
yeah, it's there's a saying that the First Amendment is as much a curse as a blessing, because it allows people, it discourages people from sounding sane. By allowing people to say extreme things, it encourages them to say extreme things. So you end up with people sort of alienating themselves from the mainstream simply because there is no need for them to be polite or restrained. And I think in a similar way, the censorship on social media has actually had a good effect, in the sense that, it would be insane for you to say extreme things about, certain ethnic groups or courses of action. So therefore you don't say those things. So therefore you actually come across better than a, you know, demented autistic 14-year-old.
I completely agree. And I think that in many ways, you guys in the UK kind of hit this before we did. So I've been listening to a lot of Jonathan Bowden's speeches recently, and he actually directly addresses this. He's like, look, like, because there is, you know, even, you know, 10, 12 years ago, there are laws on the books that mean I can't say certain things. But what I can do, you know, is I can raise objections. I can ask leading questions. You know, I can say, some people have said this. And so what that does is, for someone who, and I'm very honest, I'm not a particularly original thinker. I'm still very much in the stages of, you know, kind of discovering, you know, what ideas I agree with, what ideas I find interesting. People like Bowden, who, you know, is an extremely radical figure by, you know, any normal metric, but he's incredibly approachable because, much like you said, he's not some, you know, essentially like poltard, you know, just going off about, you know, the blacks, the Jews, you know, so on, in a way that just, you essentially play into, you know, your enemy's framing.
Exactly.
You become the, you know, the skinhead villain of every single superhero show. You know, you fit in very neatly to people's preconception about what, you know, the quote unquote crazed right wing thinks. And so to me, obviously, like, would I prefer a world in which I didn't have to censor myself, you know, in which I didn't constantly, you know, have to think up other ways to get around, you know, the gaze of Susan Wojcicki? Okay, yeah, I would, but I can't make that choice. And so, you know what, it's kind of like, well, I think that there's something to be said for the fact that limitation breeds creativity, and I think that creativity has served our movement well.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that limitation breeds creativity. That's definitely true. And I do admire that the way that this has taken place with on YouTube, but at the same time, I do I don't know. It's all to do with what you're accustomed to, really. I'm accustomed to 2014, 2015, 16, 17, where you could basically say, and where you could basically say what you wanted. And therefore, there were I made videos that you simply could not make. Well, you certainly couldn't put them on YouTube now. You absolutely couldn't do that. So I do think, as much as limitation is creatively inspiring, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. There's a lot to be said for the opposite, where, I mean, I actually did have limitations. I had technical limitations back at the start because my computer was absolutely antiquated back then. It was 2 gigabytes of RAM, and it was crashing every day. It was an absolute nightmare for the first year of my channel, first year and a half. So I did have those limitations, but creatively there were no limitations, and so it really was an open field. And I think there's a lot to be said for that as well. And I think it's a shame that you couldn't be as open as I was back then. But at the same time, there's this, Well, I think it's, as I said, it's all to do with what you're accustomed to, right? I'm accustomed to that, but I admire the people who are accustomed to a different environment and have adapted to it.
Well, I completely agree with you, because I mentally divide the internet into two periods. So being Gen Z, right, we're kind of the first digital natives, in the sense that I do remember a time pre-smartphone. I do not remember a time pre-internet at all. You know, it was never a point in my life in which I could not have access to a computer. Not that my parents allowed me to, but there was one in our house, right? And so to me, you know, being kind of a child of the internet, I very much remember that time where it was like, oh, do you want to learn how to make crack? Well, guess what? There's a video on YouTube with 1 million views that'll teach you how to make crack. You know, insert anything, right?
Like
you
can Wild see. West.
Yeah, incredible. Exactly. And so, you know, I was too young to vote for Trump the first time, but I was very much in that energy, because for a lot of people who even weren't, you know, super politically engaged, and I'm a red state American, right? So very much in, you know, MAGA country, so to speak. There was this huge energy behind it. And for a lot of guys like me who were too young to vote, but it was still something fun to do. Right. Like there were all the memes, you know, there was the SJW destroyed, you know, like there's this huge energy behind it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Then all of a sudden the internet changed and, you know, we had to worry about, you know, Russian disinformation, all these kind of things. And as someone who was kind of tangentially interested in politics, like I'm not going to lie, I've always been a nerd, but it was very much kind of, oh, this is something funny. You know, politics wasn't boring anymore, but it also wasn't particularly serious. Oh, wait, this hit. And this is a pretty common story for a lot of guys my age to slightly older. Like, wait a minute, politics hit something I found fun. So meme culture all of a sudden changed. And I'm really dating myself here. But for my, you know, age cohort, the kind of like for a while, the like real like hardcore of like very edgy. And I'm out of meme culture now. But obviously, when you're 16, you know, it's what you do. You could post and you could see incredibly edgy material on mainstream social media. So it was, a lot of it was on Instagram, right? Which now is incredibly censored, incredibly commercialized. And it always was. It was mainstream social media. But like you could watch people get beheaded if you wanted to. Like you could see all of these like extremely, you know, just out there content. And then almost overnight it changed and started walking back and walking back and walking back. And so,
and that never stopped. That's the thing. That process never stopped. I mean, I think you and I would probably agree that it's not optimal, culturally speaking, for people to be able to watch beheading videos on a mainstream website.
Yeah.
I mean, it's shitty, it's, to say the least. The trouble is that it starts with that and it ends with, well, there's a gun against your head at all times when you're speaking, and you cannot be candid, you cannot be relaxed.
Well, one of the biggest influences on me is just from a comedic standpoint, because, you know, I'm not saying I'm into comedy, but, you know, but I like to think I'm a relatively entertaining guy. And part of that is, you know, finding people who are funny and being like, okay, what worked when they did it? But a big influence on me was the company who made, you know, those old, you know, Red versus Blue, you know, Halo Machinimas, right? Rooster Teeth. And it's interesting because they're actually kind of a microcosm of this. The company has been basically demolished. You know, there's almost no one left. It's completely like sold out. And that's not particularly interesting, but it was a good microcosm of what was happening on the internet. Because first what happened is that, you know, this company, which had been around for the time, you know, 10, 15 years. So they started kind of like cutting out their edgy content. You know, then they went back and apologized and edited out, you know, edgy jokes, things that went too far, you know, things that you can't say anymore. And obviously, like, look, like the solution to this isn't better propaganda, isn't, you know, just descending back into kind of like the comfortable glow of, you know, the edgy internet. That's not my point. My point is that it was something that kind of affected everything. And so to me, at least, like, and I don't want to just endlessly whinge on about the internet, because look, I can do that. But what I kind of consider the radicalization moment for a lot of guys, you know, my age to, you know, kind of anyone in this sphere really, is the moment that kind of politics became real and politics kind of walked up and like punched you in the nose. So for me, like the internet stuff was annoying, but I was never that into, you know, the internet, at least at that point in time. But when I went to college, you know, university in 2017. And my first semester, right? Now, I don't, and it was a, you know, a pretty prestigious liberal arts school, very, very liberal. And they had this kind of gimmick set up, and it was to fix a problem that, for a variety of reasons, a lot of, you know, college bound, you know, freshmen just cannot write written English. You know, they're hopeless. And so essentially they had a system where they would trick you into signing up for a freshman elective, you know, under the guise of it being whatever you want. And in reality, it's basically a course on how to research and, you know, how to write. And so, you know, me as a, at the time, business student, I was like, all right, well, I'll take game theory. And I assumed game theory, you know, like most people, was economic game theory. What it turned out was that this was a critical theory of video games course. And so I was not involved in Gamergate, but I was taught Gamergate at a college level, which is kind of stupid.
Well, that was presumably be from a very politicized perspective.
Extremely. And this was something that I was not around for, but I essentially got not only like the full treatment of like, wait, why is nothing fun anymore? Why do I have to deal with, you know, this essentially like political pall over everything? But now I've got I actually did a stream because one of my, you know, like oldest followers has a, you know, works for a university and so has access to JSTOR. I went back through and, you know, read all of this professor's papers. And it turns out that in addition to being a Gamergate professor, she is, I kid you not, a professional clown, which I thought was mildly amusing. But nonetheless, right? So you get this like experience with, you know, kind of like shitty, you know, left-wing politics. And it's like, wait a minute, like, what have I done? Why do you hate me? And look, like, I'm not going to say that's a particularly unique story, but I think a lot of us kind of had that moment of like, I didn't really care about politics until someone decided like, I'm your problem now. And look, like, I don't want to just like rehash over like Gamergate stuff because we could do that forever. But it was kind of this moment of, I think for a lot of Zoomers, it was very easy to be politically disengaged until it kind of came to the point where it's like, look, like, no matter what your feelings on race are, if essentially there's no way for you to just be a depoliticized straight white guy, you know, that just your existence is kind of a problem to the system. Well, you know, that then you're going to seek out, you know, the people who are kind of on your side pretty quick. And I guess that's kind of what happened to me. Anyway, not to just talk about the internet.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's actually earlier than politics used to arrive in people's lives. I mean, if you were like 15 and Gamergate happens, a lot of people in previous generations wouldn't become political until they were 20, 25, even 30, because there was just no need. You'd be getting on with life. I think what happened with Gamergate is, as you say, that politics intruded upon normal life or an aspect of normal life for many people. And they were really surprised by it. They were really taken aback that suddenly they were expected to sign up to things that they'd never thought about, that they didn't have any conclusive thoughts about, and that by nature they would probably be inclined to the other side of the divide, the political divide. But they would be anti-feminist because they're, you know, men. So instead they're being told that no, you've absolutely got to be a feminist. You've absolutely got to be against horrible depictions of women in video games and so on.
Well, and I think this actually ties into, you know, what I really wanted to explicitly address on this stream, right? Which is kind of what are the broad themes of, you know, 2022, kind of a year in review. And to me, the big question of this year was, all right, like Orange Man's out of office, you know, COVID is kind of fading into the background. It's, well, are the people in charge going to, quote unquote, go back to normal, right? Like go back to the 2015 era when it was possible to be kind of depoliticized. And I think that that's why I kind of view, and look, I'm not a Republican guy. I voted for one Republican and that was election Republican. And that was to flip my state, you know, from a blue state to a red state, right? That's really the only time. So I'm not saying this is from the perspective of like a huge MAGA fan, but to me, the hinge of this year was, you know, the U.S. elections, because I kind of view that as a decision point between two.
And
that
just to be clear, that's the midterms, right?
Right. Yes, the midterms. And so essentially, that to me, that was a big question mark, you know, coming up to it, because from a certain like just pure Machiavellian perspective, you know, the argument of, all right, like the Republicans never really do anything, So it's okay to kind of throw them a bone here. You know, they'll be in charge moderately. You know, nothing really will get done. We won't pull out the, you know, the type of fortification we saw with Trump because he's not on the ticket. You know, Orange Hitler isn't coming back. And to me, that's you know, kind of a reasonable position to hold. You know, like, are we going to go back to the time in which, you know, politics aren't on everyone's mind all the time? Or is it essentially this is the new normal? And I think pretty definitively, you know, that's what we saw happen. And obviously you can say like, oh, it's cope, you know, it was always going to happen. But I mean, to me, it seems like at least probable or possible, right? That there's a reality in which, you know, the people in charge were like, all right, you know what, we'll let the proles go back to their normal lives, you know, go back to their, you know, their beer and their nachos, and they won't have to think about things anymore. And so to me, right. Oh, sorry.
What I would say to this is, the political hysteria didn't end with Trump. I agree, but that's not surprising because it didn't begin with Trump either. Gamergate predated Trump becoming president, and I think it even predated him even talking about becoming president. I believe it was 2014, 2013, 14, 15 that Gamergate happened. Trump, I think, announced in like 2015, if I recall correctly.
Well, true. And my point is more just that I think that Gamergate didn't change. Gamergate was kind of the, you know, the foreshock of the earthquake. Exactly. It was kind of a micro version. I mean, let's be honest, right? Like, there have been times in which, you know, there's kind of this realization that, like, from the acting regime, they're like, all right, we need to kind of cool our jets on this. So, for instance, right, like the campus culture of the 90s was infamously kind of like obnoxious and left wing. And well, what followed that? Well, we kind of went back into like the boner comedy, you know, 2000s, where essentially like you could still say things that were, you know, according to the regime, like racist and sexist. And we were kind of allowed to, you know, as white guys to be like, all right, well, you know what, you can be about, you know, kind of like the lads, I think is the English version of it, right? Where you can, be all about, you know, like drinking beer and, you know, in American parlance, like crushing puss and like, you can kind of just like, but like, that is like the parlance of like the, I'm trying to think who are the actors in, like the Judd Apatow comedy, right? Like sitting around.
You're talking about American Pie and
stuff like
all
that.
All that stuff.
And that was able to be walked back. Like that was an ability the regime had to kind of play that card, like containment essentially. And the big question was, all right, like they've made a big power grab for the last 5 years. You know, they've grabbed, you know, all of the, you know, all of the cultural moves that they made during COVID, during the George Floyd stuff, during Trump. And is there going to be a, on the other end, you know, a relaxation? Like they won't give you everything back, but they'll kind of loosen their touch a little bit. And to me, right, like that, I don't agree with these people. I want them to lose, but that makes rational sense to me, right? Like if I'm just this evil Machiavellian, that's what I'd do. And so the fact that didn't happen indicates kind of one of two things to me, which is either, you know, these people are essentially ideologically possessed, they're incompetent, or they think they're invincible, you know, which is kind of a subset of, you know, the other two. And so to me, that was kind of an interesting, like, kind of pivot point of this year.
That's a really interesting point. I mean, I think they are ideologically possessed. I think there's also a racial component to this. And don't, you know, remember that we're not on YouTube, so don't worry about this. I don't want to speak like it's, I don't know how direct I can be about this. It's like I can't quite go back to 2016 and just say it like it is. I think there is a drive to damage the white race, right? White America within the context of America, white Americans within the context of Europe, Europeans, and I think that has reached a sort of fever pitch. And at this point, they're just replacing us. I mean, they're just literally physically replacing us in our countries with refugees and whatever. But at the same time, they're continually demoralizing us and, you know, reprogramming us to desire our own replacement. And that's ideological stuff. It's politics. And that indoctrination isn't being relaxed at all. I agree with you about that. And I think it's, as I say, ideological. I think they can't stop. The other thing is, it's almost like sort of baked in that if you promote people in your own image long enough, there is nobody else. There's nobody else who could take over, and they don't know how to. I mean, what starts as a sort of choice eventually becomes a complete imperative. There is no option but to do this. There is nobody who knows anything any other way to be. I mean, like with Afghanistan, why did they put feminists and LGBT stuff in Afghanistan? That's obviously insane. And I think the only answer is there was nobody who knew any other way to export American values. It has to be that. What other American values are there? And indeed, that's actually a decent question in 2022, 2021 when it happened. What are the American values? It is only diversity and pride and all of that nonsense, because that's how extreme it has all become now. I mean, there aren't people who advocate the 90s liberalism or even the 2015 liberalism anymore. They've all either retired or they've got with the program, you know?
Well, and that actually is something, and I didn't write this down in my notes, but it's something that I was kind of trying to answer, you know, over the last, you know, 50 some interviews I've managed to do this year, which is the question is, that is confusing with an American accent. Are our elites, are they Machiavellian? It's just primarily interested in control, right? I want to rule by whatever means necessary. Or are they malicious? And to me, the clear answer at the end of this year is, oh, they hate you. You know, it's the Sam Hyde quote, right? Like they want you dead.
Yes.
They want your kids raped and they think it's funny. You know, paraphrased, right? But
yes.
To me, right? So I'll be perfectly honest. You know, I'm probably on the more like moderate end of this movement, just temperamentally, right? Like I'm kind of I like generally living peaceably. You know, I don't like the fact that, you know, race relations and gender relations are going badly, right? Like if there were a way to make those things go well, I'd do it, you know? And fair enough. I'm willing to accept criticism on that point. But nonetheless, right? It's impossible for me to look at this as, oh, well, they just want to be in charge, or, oh, it's just a mistake, right? Like, okay, one or two of these.
Oh, but at the I agree. The mistakes of this scale don't really get made. I mean, there are too many checks. Within the scope of an individual person, an individual person can make quite incredible mistakes. But I think when you're talking about nations and departments and all that, there are too many checks and balances. I don't really think mistakes get made. I think it's there has to be a driving force ensuring that the mistakes get made, so to speak.
No, I completely agree. And to me, the thing that I saw that really like pushed me over the edge on this was I spend, you know, a few weeks every year in northern Maine, right, which is the northernmost part of the eastern seaboard, incredibly remote. You know, and the state is, you know, 90-some% white, you know, still incredibly tight knit. And when I saw, right, buses dropping off, you know, Somalian drug addled zombies in this tiny little town in the middle of nowhere, Maine, you know, we're essentially everyone there, their ancestors have been there for, you know, 200 years plus. I guess one of the things you can't rationalize, because that's not good for the people coming off the boat or coming off the bus, rather. They're going to be, you know, live horrible, destitute lives. The people there aren't happy with it. That is an act of malice. And so to me, that kind of brings up one of the other main themes of this year for me, right? Which is we're seeing a clarification of, you know, friends and enemies. So one of the things that kind of muddied the water on this front was what I have called the COVID coalition, right? Which is this weird alliance between, you know, shall we say, like the IDW types, you know, the good liberals, people like Richard Hanania, you know, and then the radical right, you know, all the way to the MAGA types, you know, basically opposing the COVID regime, you know, the new, like, you know, the digital ID stuff, the forced vaccination, all that. Yeah. And we're seeing that fall apart for a variety of reasons. You know, one, it's just not as much a hot button issue, but I think also we're seeing people's kind of first order loves. So there's an idea in in Christian theology, right? And this goes, you know, from Augustine, you know, Lewis, you can find it throughout the whole thing. Essentially that what you love most is what you worship. And obviously that has a theological implication, but also a political implication. And we've seen very quickly with a lot of people, and I'm going to use Sam Harris as an example, because he just out and out said it. You know, he's not smart enough to kind of keep it, you know, keep it hidden. But we saw very quickly, well, who was someone who actually believed in these admittedly unrealistic ideas of, you know, personal liberty, you know, the kind of like the true like liberal believers, right? And who just wanted to be essentially mildly edgy liberals, you know? And we saw that in that quote that like, look, like, I don't care if Hunter Biden has a dead baby in his basement, you know, as long as Orange Man isn't in the office. And obviously that's a particularly egregious example, but I think that we've seen a lot of those, you know, kind of like alliances of convenience fall by the wayside. And so I think that's another kind of big emerging dynamic of this year.
Yeah. And of course, another example would be Jordan Peterson, who was even quite instrumental, even as recently as the start of this year with the Canadian trucker convoy. And then at the end of this, you know, like, so he starts the year mediating between the truckers and the government in a sense. And then he ends the year ranting about, well, on YouTube troll and demons, Twitter,
yeah.
about psychopathic, Machiavellian, cowardly, anonymous troll demons. That's quite an odyssey, isn't it? Just in one single, in the space of what, 10 months?
well, right. And look, like, I'm very much, you know, kind of like a man of my generational cohort in the sense that, like, I owe a lot to Jordan Peterson. Right. Like when I kind of left, I dropped out of college. I was extremely disillusioned, you know, by essentially going to this like, you know, liberal indoctrination, you know, and I could rattle off stories all night. And so like I kind of found, you know, the first open port in the storm, which was, you know, the IDW Jordan Peterson stuff. And so I get the complaint like, oh, if you had a dad, you wouldn't need to listen to Jordan Peterson talks. And okay, fair enough. But nonetheless, right, we can't deny the fact that there are a lot of people here because of him. And so because of that, I had defended him in the past, you know, infamously, you know, I defended him to my everlasting shame when speaking to Ryan Turnipseed. You know, I was like, oh, he's not that bad. Like he'll come back around. And then almost a week later, right, he shows up in Israel, you know, talking to Netanyahu and has done everything he's done. And so I think that you're dead on that, you know, we really see, you know, use an idiom, you know, on which side these people's bread is buttered, you know, and it turns out that, okay, they were a little bit outside the allowable Overton window of 2016. And they made a big, you know, fuss about, you know, pronouns, and they made a big fuss about COVID. But when it came down to it, you know, they're happy to be edgy. They're happy to be, you know, outsiders, but only to a point. And look, I'm not saying everyone has to spend their entire life, you know, spurging out about the JQ, because I think that's counterproductive. But you really do see like, all right, like who's willing to actually take a hit? And I think that what we've seen is as the, you know, the regime has kind of upped its explicit attacks, you know, for instance, as part of this like transition to a weird banana republic state that America is going through, we've seen these like absolutely ridiculous attacks on regime enemies. So, right, like the Trump Mar-a-Lago raid, which I think is a pretty big deal, you know, just as a thing that happened, you know, set aside your opinions about Trump. But then even more so with Alex Jones getting these ridiculous lawsuits, like $1 billion. And guess what? They're coming back for $1.2 trillion, at which point it's like, why even put numbers? Just say all his money, you know, like it's stupid. But nonetheless, right, we're seeing that essentially like hard times are coming. You know, the regime doesn't like people like us, and it's going to make moves on us. And so what I think that we're going to see is that it will become apparent very quickly who's serious and who's not. And obviously I'm by no means, you know, telling anyone to do something stupid, you know, like stay in the system as long as you can. But I think that if you're not looking around and kind of saying like, all right, like what's my plan B? You know, what do I have, a parachute? Do I have an option to at least be, you know, like minimally under these people's control? I think that's a bad move, because the big fish have already started to, you know, to take heat, right? Like everyone says like, oh, like the unpersoning of Alex Jones, you know, that was a dire signal. That was a canary in a coal mine. Well, guess what? Alex Jones just got you know, brought up for being stupid, you know, for saying something dumb. And it cost him like an incomprehensible amount of money for no reason, right? In civil court.
Yeah, and so it's incredible, and it seems to do nothing less than nullify the First Amendment in effect, because if a lobby group doesn't like something you've said, then they can claim you've offended people by saying it, and they can ruin your life. I mean, this is incredible, I think.
Well, and that goes back to the thing that drives me absolutely nuts about these kind of like pet conservatives. So if you know anything about, you know, Dave the Distributist, who's a significant influence of mine, you know, he has this obsession with BreadTube, right? And he's a, you know, a blue state, you know.
I was surprised he didn't mention Adam and Sitch last night. I was waiting for it, but it didn't happen. I think he's maybe got that under control.
So I have a similar obsession with kind of like, quote unquote, good conservatives. So recently I've been kind of on a jihad against David French and Rod Dreher. And Rod Dreher in particular, for those who don't know, is actually someone who's kind of important to my intellectual development. You know, he's been a, you know, a journalist for a while, and in kind of conservative Christian circles, he made waves primarily with his release of this book called The Benedict Option, which has a hidden red pill in it that was really important for my own development. And essentially the argument of this book is, look, conservative Christians, conservative religious people in America are a minority. You know, the culture is not looking up for us. So essentially, we're going to have to start approaching life like a minority. You know, we're going to have to essentially play by a different set of rules, which it doesn't take too much thinking to realize, like, wait a minute, there's a hidden red pill there, right? So that was incredibly important to me. But what he's done is essentially, when faced with someone, you know, in a similar religious community to his, who is involved in the Christian nationalist sphere, right? Which I'm not a huge proponent of. I think it's kind of dumb and limited, but nonetheless, right? Like, not the most wild out there thing on the right wing internet. Just had a hissy fit, you know, screaming and crying, like, and essentially doxed this guy, you know, got his life completely ruined, made this, you know, poor guy who was an editor, you know, wasn't even a prolific author, just essentially worked on someone else's work, you know, made him unemployable, tried to get his crowdfunding taken down. And you look at this and you're like, wait a minute, you're allegedly supposed to be a quote unquote dissident Republican, you know, a dissident conservative. You're supposed to be out there. But what you've seen in this, and I think this is the thing that kind of draws people like, you know, Peterson and French and Dreher together, is that you see who their quote unquote political god is. You see who they worship. And well, guess what? They bow down to Baal. You know, that they've shown you who their, you know, who essentially their master is. And I'm using religious, you know, metaphors here essentially to just be a little bit dramatic. But nonetheless, I think that what we've seen is, you know, given a crisis, how people act, you know, and look, like, obviously you don't want bad things to happen. But I think that this is information we can't forget. And look, a lot of the older guys, you know, a lot of the guys who've been around for longer, they were calling this out before I noticed, you know, so I'm not trying to say this is some, like, you know, revelation on my part. But I think that's another kind of like lesson of 2022 that can't be avoided, right? Like, who is really our friend and who is really our enemy? And I also, like, just want to remind everyone, don't let these people back in. You know, they've shown you that they will betray you. You know, don't come back around and be like, but Dave Chappelle's base, look at what he said. You know, like, oh, he made the libtards mad. Doesn't matter. He's not our friend. And that doesn't mean you have to counter signal him. You know, that doesn't mean you have to, you know, spurg out about him, but just don't support him, because he won't support you. And I guess that's kind of one of my other big points this year.
Well, I mean, an interesting question is, why are we in this situation where, because you said, how will people react? How will people behave in a crisis, in an emergency? And an interesting question is, why are we in a crisis? Why is it a constant state of emergency? Why is the temperature always so high? I mean, forgive me for, I don't mean to be patronizing. You might not be able to remember what it was like when, well, I think you can, based on what you've said, what it was like when life wasn't like this, when people could basically have whatever opinions they wanted and there wouldn't be a social penalty. There might, certainly not a formal one, there might be people who thought, he's a racist. He's some sort of dick. But they wouldn't be trying to get you your fired from your job. They wouldn't be making a point of telling everyone that you're a racist. Nobody really cared. And, you know, this was, I would say, the case definitely in the 90s. And I would think even most of the 2000s, really. And I think the turning point, in my view, would be Trayvon Martin. I think that was 2012. Or maybe 2013. In fact, let me just make sure of that. Easily find out.
I want to say it was...
Yeah, 2012. Yeah,
yeah, it was 2012. Yeah. So to me... My first big political memory is Obama's first election, right? I was 9 years old. And because I lived in kind of like red state America, you know, among certain members of my family who were extremely conservative, I remember even then being like, guys, I don't think McCain has this. Like, I'm sorry. He just doesn't seem that interesting. He doesn't seem that compelling, you know, to a guy who's in grade school, right? And when you look around and, you know, every street corner has an Obama sign in a red state and you haven't seen a McCain sign all day, you kind of start to do the math. And so what I think happened is in that the first term, Obama was supposed to be the big antichrist. But to be honest, right, like he governed relatively kind of like normally, you know, it wasn't that abnormal. But what happened essentially is that in his second term, he kind of went off the rails, you know, and he really started to lean into, and the Trayvon Martin situation is a great example, right? You know, that he could have been my son, things like that, like really leaning into the racial stuff. And so what I kind of think happened is that the caliber of government dropped off dramatically after the Cold War, right? Like Bill Clinton is a joke of a president. You know, he would do these like weird crocodile tears, you know, he had his like goofy Southern accent and he just wasn't a particularly, he was a good politician, but I mean, like, look at the difference between him and H.W. You know, like, H.W. is a serious man. And so on one point, there's the part that, like, the pressure's let off. You know, we don't have this existential enemy anymore. And I think that the other one is that the tap of American prosperity started to kind of run dry. You know, like, each generation has, like, just had less and less opportunity to the point where it's like, realistically, I'll never own a home in my life. You know, maybe in my 40s. And so what I think happened... is that and I just want to finish this thought so it doesn't like leave it hanging in the air.
Of course.
Is that, you know, for Gen Xers, there was this rebellion, right? And that's my parents' generation. So I understand a little bit, right? That there was this idea that like, oh, the boomers weren't true to their roots. You know, they sold out, right? And you see this in all like the music and the media of the time. But there was enough prosperity to bring them back in. Right. Like they got their corporate jobs. They started making money. You know, they started, you know, essentially getting the kind of like the carrot that would bring the horse back around. But what happened with millennials is, well, one, they didn't really have a particularly cohesive culture to begin with. Right. They didn't have any economic prosperity. And essentially they were given this option of, oh, politics will save you. You know, Obama is going to be this great hope and he'll change everything. And then, well, Obama the second time around, he's going to save everything. And it's just been this like rising tide of essentially that, you know, while everything gets like more and more shit that like, oh, well, politics, like John Lennon's Imagine is just another $1 million. It's just another couple hundred thousand refugees away. And I think that people essentially have nothing else to tie their lives to, you know, like say what you will, like, look, I'm not saying we should all, you know, be like, you know, ultra based, you know, like extremist Christians, but like essentially people have no, like we live in a pointless society. You know, there's no war to fight. There's no greater deity to tie your, you know, your meaning to. And as like consumerism becomes a less and less, you know, like, I guess like suitable fill or like, you know, fill for the void in people's hearts. Well, they've created a new religion and it's a civic religion. And you see it both in kind of the obvious, like, you know, negrophilia of, you know, like the current state religion of kind of like the State Department, you know, like the mainstream media, but I think also in kind of like the cult of Trump. And so I guess that's my thesis on that.
See, it's a really interesting topic. I mean, I think that, and I did several videos about this very early on about that. Like, I was personally in a very bad position, but that was for my own reasons. It wasn't a sort of I wouldn't say that it was emblematic of the millennials to be in my predicament, but it was more to do with my own choices, really. But I knew people who were in, I'll just say it outright. I knew a lot of people who were not in a similar position to what their parents had been in at the same age. In other words, lots of millennials who were 30, I mean, this is like 10 years ago almost, lots of millennials who were about 30. Now, when their parents were 30, they had a professional job, they were married, they had their first kid or even several kids, and they had disposable income, and they were on the property ladder. That's the key thing. So, but their kids, the people I knew, had like a crappy job, definitely not on the property ladder. Most of them weren't married, and the ones who were didn't have kids. Very few of them had kids. So basically, it was quite clear that the dream of consumerism was fading. And I didn't know, and I still don't really know, the reasons why that's happened. I think a lot of it is automation, a lot of it is offshoring to China and whatever. Industry has just died everywhere. And software has meant that a lot of middle-class jobs just don't need to be done by humans anymore. And I'm sure that there are other reasons as well. But for whatever reasons, the middle class was clearly falling apart, and the working class was largely screwed already. So what you ended up with, and if you're not going to have the same stature in society that your parents had, money, options, freedom, etc., then you'll look for some other way to be a good person and to make your mark and to impress your peers, and that's beliefs. That seems to be what we have now. Now, I was listening to a sociologist guy a few months ago, and he was saying that this is very prevalent among the upper class. 100 years ago, they flaunted their status by way of material possessions, material wealth. What they do now is they flaunt their status by way of the beliefs that they profess. But I think this is also true in the middle class as well. I think that the millennials have placed a huge amount of stock in what beliefs you hold, because they don't really have much else. I mean, you take it away.
No, I completely agree with you. And this is actually one of the many reasons I despise kind of like basic bitch conservatives, is that they on one hand, they get it. Right. They'll say things like, oh, like we just need to go back to, you know, a time in which people didn't place so much emphasis on these kind of like, you know, ideological presuppositions. Like, oh, like go back to the 50s, you know, when politics was a very like, you know, background thing. Obviously people had positions, but, you know, it was this kind of like depoliticized society. And that's right. But the problem with that is that essentially that is an exceptional time in human development. That was never something that was going to be sustainable. And so when I look at it, and look, like I'm by no means an expert. You know, I have a finance undergraduate degree. You know, so it's like kind of the waters I swim in, but I'm 23 years old. I'm not an expert. But to me, the way I look at it is essentially we made a bunch of decisions for short-term gain. You know, we essentially kind of like spent down the capital of the business, you know, to buy us nice things, under the kind of expectation that we could keep doing that forever. You know, that kind of like exponential growth curve, you know, that separated our grandparents from our great grandparents, that we could, the line would go up forever. And I think that what we've seen is essentially that the West's patrimony was not boundless. There was a hard limit on that account. And it seems like we've kind of started to overdraft, you know, to really draw this metaphor out to like a painful conclusion. But to me, that kind of like goes back to like what I consider the last big like theme of this, that the first world isn't really special anymore. And not to say that there aren't good things here, not to say that it isn't still nicer in, you know, San Francisco than Caracas, but like we kind of spent all of our parents' wealth. You know, like we've become the, you know, like this society that is burnt through, you know, essentially 500, you know, 1,000 years of capital to what, blow itself up twice and make sure that our grandparents get to live in, you know, cushy houses in Florida. And look, like, I don't want to just skewer the boomers, because to a certain extent, they were sold a pack of lies. And especially I think that what we've also seen is that and this is a Richard Weaver point, like, you know, kind of like very old, like Barry Goldwater type conservatives, that there's been this line forever, like, oh, you liberals, like, your ideas are eventually going to catch up to you. You know, and a lot of those people meant it in a personal context, right? Like, oh, if you go off and be a hippie, like, you'll end up destitute and out on the street. And that may have been the case in a certain number of examples. But essentially, these kind of luxury beliefs, these luxury ideas, you know, that all people are the same, that, oh, if we just have, you know, if we just, you know, if we let the mentally insane, you know, under their own recognizance, well, they'll turn out fine. You know, those were ideas that you could kind of tolerate in small doses. And the example I like to use is sand in an engine. You know, if you put one or two grains of sand in your oil cap, well, you'll be fine. You know, but the moment you start adding handfuls, you're going to create a problem. And essentially, in the same way that we have run out of capital at an exponential rate, these kind of beliefs, these luxury beliefs that made us feel good, well, they all added a little bit. They added one or two straws to the camel's back. And the problems that, you know, the reactionaries, the conservatives of their day, you know, brought up, they didn't seem like issues. You know, like, oh, well, nothing bad really happened, you know, from busing. Nothing bad really happened, you know, from the pill. And over a 10-year scale, they may have been right. But it seems to me, right, like all at once, kind of we're seeing this like flurry of chickens coming home to roost. And look, like, I don't mean to sound endlessly black-pilled or depressed about it, but it does seem to me that, like, we're kind of starting to, the bill has come due in many ways.
Oh yeah, and this is something that, I mean, this is what we have to deal with. It's difficult not to depress people when you talk about this. It's simply a bad situation, and I agree. I think up until say 10 years ago, or even less, really. Probably up until, let's say the mid-2010s, I think it would be difficult to, like, an individual, you or me, might think that society is in a bad way, but it would be very difficult to convey that to a politically disinterested person. They'd be like, eh, come on, it's fine. But I think that nowadays, that has really changed, because the bill has come due in a big way, and it sort of accelerated suddenly, so that the problems are not avoidable anymore. And a big manifestation of this would be the mass immigration, refugees. I mean, it's just absolutely omnipresent now. I don't know if there are any towns or villages in Britain that have not been touched by this yet. It's everywhere. And I know that's a particular thing, that it's not like we set it up or the boomers set it up 50 years ago and the bill has now come due. It's the culmination of many problems that at the time were probably dismissed as not very important. The conservative in the academy moaning about some lefty academic who's just got the job and has wild ideas. Well, that conservative could be dismissed as just some old fuddy-duddy. Well, now that lefty academic rules the roost and has promoted many people in their own image, and now there is nobody who can even formulate an argument as to why that ancient town should not be injected with refugees. Nobody can even say, well, why shouldn't it happen?
Well, and that brings me to kind of my last big main theme of 2022. And this one is probably my most controversial one, is that I think that we've finally seen, you know, a refutation of populism, right? Like, the copium is finally run out. You know, like, which of those major, you know, ultra-based 2016 era populists, who's still around? You know, Bolsonaro's gone, Trump is gone, you know, the super hardcore populist Alexander Johnson, he's gone. And a part of that, I think, is a realization that I realize we know this, you know, our people know this, but this is an idea that has to be kind of gently explained to, you know, kind of like the normie conservative, you know, the average red stater, that like, look, like, you can't vote your way out of this one. You know, and I'm not advocating for anything, you know, radical at all. I'm just saying the fact that, like, don't give these people your respect. You know, they're not, they're going to say they're trying to save you, but they're not. You know, they just want to manage the decline. They want it to go on for longer. And to me, right, I really don't understand how you can look at this situation, right, this kind of, like, culmination of so many trends all at once and say, like, all right, well, yeah, if we just get a majority, I think we can handle it in 4 years, you know, or 2 years. Like, we got this. Right. It's not that bad.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this is why it amazed me when Trump said when he was announcing that he was going to stand in 2020, when he was still the president and he was saying that he was going to stand again. And he announced that his slogan was going to be "Keep America Great." So it's like, in the space of 3 or 4 years, you have made America great again. Are you joking? Man alive, do you have no idea of the scope of the problems that you were supposed to be dealing with? You cannot deal with them in 3 years or 4 years. This is multi-generational. But he's such a showman and such a buffoon that he didn't even... I mean, you could say maybe he just chose that slogan randomly, or it was bravado, but... I don't think it was, actually. I think it was sheer delusion and hubris on his part.
Well, and this kind of ties into, I guess, the issue that kind of grew my channel the most, which is, you know, the dialogue that went on, you know, several months ago about America. You know, essentially, is America the great Satan? And obviously, as an American and as someone who really loves the place that I'm from, you know, I live in an area of the country that's very special, and I, you know, plan on dying here. You know, I refuse to leave no matter how bad it gets. But I think that we need to come to this realization as, you know, as Americans, that even if we, and I speak as the, you know, the citizenry, right? Like the people who live there, the founding stock, don't like this. Well, it's what our country does. You know, and if our country on the world stage needs to take a tumble so that this goes down, I think that's a trade we have to be willing to make. And two, these people, right, the populists, you know, the ultra based, you know, Republican Party, who's really going to do something this time, guys, I promise. You know, we're going to win. If we just vote harder, you know, if we just elect the based black man, you know, if we just nominate him to the Supreme Court, it'll all be fine. I'm not minimizing, you know, any victories, right? Like, a win is a win, but all the same, like, we need to, these people don't deserve our respect. And you need to build up the same type of disdain you have, you know, towards insert your favorite shitlip, you know, to Ash Sarkar, to AOC, to any one of these, like, horribly awful, you know, skintellectuals, you know, these kind of, like, retarded progressives. And there is something on a spiritual level, and this is something that Junger gets at, right? That, and he talks about this in, I believe, The Forest Passage, you know, where he's like, look, like, by playing their game, you know, and he's specifically talking about, like, voting for an autocrat, you know, or voting for a dictator. But I think this kind of applies in our own, like, odd, you know, unofficial kind of, like, hellscape dictatorship of no one. That by playing their game, you grant it dignity, right? Like, you're signing your name to it. And so, look, like, does not voting for Republicans, does not getting out there for Trump 2, does that really solve the problem? No, not really. But I guess just stop caring so much. Stop, like, devoting your time, you know, like, putting your effort into someone who so clearly has no interest in helping you at all. You know, they just want to essentially the most pathetic scrap of power they can get. And that's not, I realize, a super organized thought, but it's kind of connected to that idea of, like, I guess, broader identification of who your friends and who your enemies are. Because, like, not only did the populists fail, not only were they bad at playing politics, well, they weren't even good at helping us, even in the smallest way. So I guess that's kind of, like, my last big theme of 2020.
Yeah, yeah. On the matter of conservatives saying that we should just vote harder, do you think they still believe that after the US election of 2020? Because surely that, I mean, I would think that showed that it really doesn't matter how hard he vote. The system has made the decision already.
So you'd think that. And there are some who are like that, you know, but so look, like my grandparents are lovely people. I, you know, have a great deal of affection for them, but they're prime baby boomers, right? They were born in 1950, you know, had the whole experience, you know, and they're, you know, they're Republicans. And it's funny because I literally had this interaction with them where I was like, look, like, do you think that Trump lost the 2020 election? They're like, no, it was stolen from him. I'm like, okay. Do you think that the Democrats are ruining the country? You know, speaking their language. And they're like, yeah, of course. Do you think that they're corrupt? Yes. Yes. Do you think that they're evil? Yeah. All of this, you know, like they're the worst, you know, they'll do anything to stay in power. And so then I was like, well, okay. Like, why are you voting? And they're like, what's the right thing to do? And I think that what we're seeing now and what we've seen is the replacement of the old American civic religion. Right, like the apple pie, the George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and maybe Robert E. Lee too, you know, that many of our grandparents were brought up with. Like that has been fully and totally displaced. And so I have a lot of sympathy for, you know, kind of like the boomer conservatives, for the normie cons, because to a certain extent, they're playing with outdated software. You know, they are still playing according to the rules of, you know, 1974 or 1954. And I honestly think that for many of these people, especially with older people, things like voting, we shouldn't think of it like how we do, like a political action. Like for them, it's a religious right. And so really, like, I think that there's a lot of futility in trying to like red pill the boomers. You know, red pill, especially like older normicons, because for many of them, it's an article of faith. You know, voting is not a rational choice. It's just something that good people do. But, and look, there have definitely been people who've been moved by this, but I don't see a huge change in kind of like the average conservative voter.
Yeah, I agree. I do think, I mean, it's a horrible thing to say, actually, but I do think that a lot of them, I mean, there's no point trying to get through to them. If they are going to see it, they'll see it. Otherwise, just leave them to their delusion, because you'll be grinding metal trying to get through to them.
Well, and it's actually, and
I've seen this myself. You know, they've believed this stuff all their lives, and for them, that's a long time. That's like 60, 70, 80 years. They're not going to change, or they're very unlikely to change now.
And so this is actually something that I agree with Curtis Yarvin on. And I think that, kind of taken as a whole, his essay on, you know, hobbits and dark elves was kind of atomic level cringe. But he did raise a very good point, which is that, like, look, like a good society is not a political society. You know, the end goal is to essentially overcome politics. And specifically, he used the example of kind of like the, you know, the pre and post, you know, imperial Rome. You know, the idea that, like, well, when a solution was reached, politics, like the political issue stopped. You know, that most people just did not need to concern themselves with how things are running. You know, that's only like a degraded state of things. And I actually completely agree, because I think that like one of the most insidious lies of liberalism and democracy is that most people can or should concern themselves with how the society is run. You know, I think that the vast majority of people genuinely go along to get along, and that's fine. Like, you shouldn't have disdain for these people. You know, they're performing the important functions of society, right? Like, they're making sure that things work, you know, the lights turn on and such. And so, like, I think that it's important to recognize the fact that, yeah, these people aren't deep thinkers, but you also shouldn't, and I'm not saying you, woes, I'm speaking like the collective you know, shouldn't have disdain for these people, because to be honest, like, in a well-run society, their attitudes would suit them well. You know, like the idea that, oh, you just go along to get along, in the vast majority of human societies, that's how you should act. Like I feel like we are, you know, as these kind of like extremely disagreeable dissident types are in a weird way kind of like uniquely suited to this age, because I there's kind of a vision that haunts me, you know, and kind of like the era changes, but it's of a version of me in a highly functional society, you know, where I'm just as like disagreeable. Yeah. I'm just as like, you know, willing to buck trends, But instead of doing something that's actually like kind of like productive and life affirming, well, I'm just some like, I'm like the 16th century version of a shit lip, you know, because I just have to be a little bit disagreeable.
Yeah. I know exactly what you mean. I've often wondered, what would I be doing in different eras? Would I be constantly moaning about decline and finding problems with my society? Or would I know when to just enjoy it, just enjoy the high point? I hope I would. But yeah, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? What should the correct relationship be between those who are naturally disagreeable and those who are naturally compliant and sort of peaceful and just trying to get by in life? It's a whole thing, isn't it?
No, it definitely is. And so to me, I think that this breaks down, and I'm not the person to come up with this. I think Charlemagne is the one that brought this up first. But it's the difference between what he considers a conservative temperament and a reactionary temperament, right? So these are both types of people that you can find on the right wing, you know, for as much as that term is useful for anything. But on one hand, you know, a conservative is someone who essentially is like, well, I don't want things to change, you know, and in the vast majority of, you know, times, that's a pretty sensible position to hold, you know, like, well, you don't really want to mess with things because generally society's working pretty well. But on the other hand, I think you have what Charlemagne called, you know, reactionaries, which are basically people who are hierarchical, you know, interested in order on the right wing, but are also very open, essentially like, well, all right, like we need new solutions. And I think that one of the things that we need to absorb is that fundamentally we cannot go back. You know, the genie's out of the bottle. There are certain things that are just always going to exist. You know, like the idea that we can go on like a Butlerian jihad, you know, and throw, you know, the recipe for birth control into Mount Doom, you know, turn off the internet. Like, I just don't think it's particularly realistic. You know, like maybe it'd be nice, you know, if that's how things worked. But fundamentally, right, like society is, you know, it's a dialectic. You know, there's a point, there's a counterpoint, you know, there's a thesis, there's an antithesis. And so I think that, you know, as these kind of like disagreeable, like asshole types, and I say that with a little bit of affection, right? Like we kind of do need to be casting around for solutions because the traditional tool belt that, you know, civilization left us with is not adequate to our problems. You know, we've essentially, and that doesn't mean like, look, like I'm a firm believer that human nature is a constant, you know, that like, okay, fair enough. Technology can change, situations can change, but people are kind of the same, like shitty beings they always are. But nonetheless, right? Like, we are kind of outside the parameters, you know, that the past has kind of equipped us to deal with. And obviously that doesn't mean, you know, what the progressives think, which is essentially like, all right, then we can remake ourselves, you know, that we can just reject our humanity. But nonetheless, I do think that there is this counterproductive desire on the right to essentially like bury our heads in the sand and just make it go back. And I think that, you know, as much as I wish that were the case, like we actually are going to have to take some things from the progressives. We're going to have to take some things from the liberals just because that's how ideas work. You know, no idea is kind of made in a vacuum. And much like Moldbug said that there's no such thing as a pure atheist. You know, you're either a Christian atheist or a Hindu atheist. I think that all of us kind of have to admit that we are essentially liberal reactionaries for as little sense as that makes. You know, like we're kind of irreparably shaped by, you know, whatever this ideology is.
Yeah, I agree. We're sort of refugees from it at this point. okay, let me go through some super chats. Darby says, Jay Barden is right about traitors. Happy to know there are other guys my age who get it. Less lonely. There you go. INM says, traitors are the most dangerous potential enemy. Darby says that the turning point was mass social media usage in the early 2010s.
I would have a kind of a qualified, you know, agree, disagree on that. I think that it enabled it, definitely. And I think that kind of this like obsession with curating your personal brand and kind of displaying activism as part of that, I think that that's definitely a factor. But I think that if you, as much as I am one to agree that social media is kind of driving everyone insane, I don't think that it's the primary driver there. I think it's a significant one, but not the top of the list.
Yeah. It's an instrument. It's not a cause in itself. Okay, Privileged Shitlord says, let's splurge, it's Christmas. Thank you very much. Black Pigeon Pilled says, what does Jay Burden think will come of the elite shift towards advocating COVID amnesty? This is a few months ago. Yeah.
So my take on this is maybe a little bit outside the box. I actually think that the vast majority of the right fell for the gambit here. I think that essentially our elites don't need to ask for COVID amnesty. They can just do it. And they also don't need to spend a particularly long amount of time seeding an idea before they just go full steam ahead. COVID is a great example. Like, I'm sure you all remember, you know, Nancy Pelosi, you know, going to Chinatown and, you know, hugging people, going to the wet market, and then almost immediately afterwards, you know, shutting everything down, right? Intentionally using that phrase. But what I think that that was is I think that was essentially a trap to make everyone who was a dissident on COVID look terrible by basically offering up an opportunity for all of the like right wingers, you know, frog Twitter to essentially post like the Giga Chad no, or like face the wall, like essentially step into their role as the stock villain. And I think that a lot of people fell for that and basically said like, oh no, I'll stick your head on a pike. And then screenshot, guess what? You've just discredited the whole, like essentially like COVID skeptic community. And that may be overly dramatic, but I do think that that was essentially, that was the Matador's cape, and we just charged straight through it.
Ah, well, that's depressing, because I certainly took part in that. I mean, I just felt like it's outrageous for them to be asking for or suggesting this when they are the ones in the wrong. I don't know. You're probably right that when they have the narrative reins, they can make whatever narrative they want. You know, they can just decide, yeah, well, we are now being reasonable and they're now being unreasonable. Isn't that terrible?
Well, and I think that that's one of my other kind of criticisms of the right wing is that they, right wingers, I think, understand left wing culture just through cultural output more than vice versa. But I think that a lot of times they project their own like common sense and reasonableness onto the left, in the sense that, you know, a conservative would kind of imagine like, oh, if I were writing that article, I would legitimately be asking for COVID amnesty, you know, but I don't think they realize how asymmetrical the power relationship is. And part of that is that liberals love to pretend like they're the underdog. Yes. But I think the conservatives are all, and like the right, I won't say conservatives, but the right is all too eager to essentially like beat their chest and crow and say, we got to win, you know, even when it's like such a minute win. And in the grand scheme of things, like it's a W, like take it, but don't pretend like you're the one actually deciding if they get amnesty or not. You know, I guess that's my last thought on it.
Yeah. I see. I know exactly what you're saying. I think that it plays into the right's notion that things are actually fair, and that there isn't a narrative being constantly pushed and designed and refined. They think that they actually have the authority.
And Black Pigeon has the exact phrase. It's imagine if the roles were reversed, and that's exactly what I'm talking about.
Yes, yes. Well, I've got a meme, a gravestone, and it says, here lies conservatism. Imagine if the roles were reversed.
That's a good one. I didn't know you were the origin of that, but that's like an all-time classic.
No, I didn't create that one, but I've just got it in my folder. It's quite an amusing one. All right, well, let's wrap this one up, and because I'm starting to get tired. It's that time of the night. But anyway, this has been a really enjoyable one. I liked this, and it's we've touched on a lot of different issues and points. And it's interesting because I mean I can sense that you're this is going to sound patronizing. I don't mean it to be. I can sense that you're young and sort of testing these ideas, but at the same time, you definitely do have a perspective, and it's interesting to hear it because you're seeing things that I've seen for like 10, 20 years, but you're seeing them from the vantage point of a 23-year-old. And it's interesting how it clearly different things appear differently, as you would probably expect.
And I always want to kind of like couch everything I say with that, you know, that kind of like qualifier on the front end that like, look, like I'm a young guy. I'm not trying to say like I discovered this thing, because obviously there are a lot of guys who've been doing this, you know, far longer than I have. And so I really appreciate those kind words. I'll take that to heart.
Okay, excellent. Well, you're welcome. All right, well, I will be back in about 40 minutes with Blood Satellite. But in the meantime, Jay Barden, thank you for appearing on Millennial 8.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
All right. Bye-bye for now, everyone.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. Bitcoin, Ethereum, Monero, and other cryptocurrencies are all very welcome. Get the info you need at millennial.com/crypto and make your donation today. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.